there's something grandiose about what I've done, audacious, and I will often get off stage and look at my bandmates or look at whoever is there side stage and go, I just got away with it again. Like I'm robbing a bank or something.
Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Vermont-born rock star Grace Potter releases her seventh studio album this week. Trespasser is the latest offering from the four-time Grammy nominee. Grace Potter burst onto the music scene in 2002 with her first band, Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. After that group disbanded in 2015, Potter has gone on to tour with some of the country's top musicians, including the Rolling Stones, Kenny Chesney, and country star Chris Stapleton, with whom she's touring next month. Potter will bring her act to Burlington on September 18th, when her annual Grand Point North Festival kicks off. Profits will go towards Potter's Grand Point Foundation, a nonprofit dedicated to supporting the arts in Vermont. Potter, who's 43, divides her time between homes in the Mad River Valley of Vermont, where she grew up and attended high school, and Topanga Canyon, California. Trespasser was produced by her husband and frequent collaborator Eric Valentine, with whom Potter has a son. Here's a clip of Love Me Not from Trespasser.
When I'm dead and gone, will you still say I was wrong? When I'm flying up on high, will you wave as I float by? I need to understand why you let me go. And if that
Grace Potter, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Let's jump right in to talk about the album you're about to go on a national tour for, Trespasser.
Yes.
Talk about the inspiration and the meaning of trespassing to you.
Well, you know, I grew up in a place where I think the limits were unknown to me. And boundaries were unknown to me. Growing up with baby boomer, awesome, back to the land, hippie parents that essentially just wandered up into a piece of America that felt available. And of course, all the nuances that go with making yourself feel at home somewhere. There's a bit of an audacity to that, isn't it? Like, it's interesting because my mom and dad ended up becoming really good friends with many of the farmers who had been here, some of whom had been here for hundreds of years, and families. In fact, the farm we live on is a family that had been here since 1840, only to be bought out by a family from Connecticut in the 60s, and then we bought it from that family. So we're not that many generations deep into claiming and reclaiming things and setting boundaries and then breaking those boundaries. And I feel like the world I grew up in was always a gray area. And yet, as I got into music and started traveling out into the world, I became more aware that there are places where those boundaries matter a lot, and there's places where those boundaries loosen. And I don't know if I'm more attracted to one or the other, but I certainly like to understand the culture around each thing and just put things in perspective through music. It's my Rosetta Stone for understanding this sort of difficult and confusing emotional landscape of this land is your land or this land is not your land.
So let's talk about the lyrics. So you sing, "I knew you were coming before you knew it yourself. Felt your hate on my street sign, smelled your napalm breath. I took a walk towards the sunset. That was my first mistake. As I hurried home, I heard an icy refrain, 'Bow to the master, bow to the master.'" What are you talking about there?
I was feeling a lot. I mean, I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about that feeling. That was a biological response to several sets of dumpster fires that were going on, both on a universal scale in society at large during COVID, also in my internal turmoil of, am I supposed to be a protect? I was a new mom. Am I meant to be a protector and a lioness and a, at all costs protect your own? Or is there space for empathy here? And beyond all of that, I also we had a home invasion at our house, and
In
somebody,
California or Vermont?
it was in California. Somebody strolled in, and they were in the midst of a mental crisis, but they came, they had no shoes on, they were in like a full uniform as if they had just come from probably some kind of a government facility where they had been detained and had wandered or escaped, and had found their way onto our property and had been there for quite some time. We were in, met as many people were, we were in our little echo chamber, our bubble, our little sanctuary, or this place that we thought was ours. But as a Vermont girl, I left the gates open and all these, lovely, inviting looking Christmas lights on all around our property. And this person just let themselves in, and they came in and said, "What are you doing in my house?" They said that to us. So this person was like, "My wife called me to dinner and she's not here. Did you eat her?" And they asked if we had eaten all of their cookies, and they said some pretty wild stuff about how we were the locusts that had hatched in the belly of this ancient demon that he'd been watching for centuries. And this man was really in a specific type of mental break from reality, which oddly enough, the as much as my physical biology, I had my baby was like couldn't walk yet, and I had this really visceral reaction initially to be afraid and run away. Then I had another to be combative and to like pony up and knife up and get, my Teflon. I think I had some like tactical gear looking pants. I was like, I could go change into my combat boots and my tactical pants and scare him. And then when I came back down the stairs after we had called 911, and secured my young son in a safe place, I found my husband sitting with this man, talking about his tattoo, which looked like the cover of Dark Side of the Moon. It was a triangle with a prism rainbow going through it, and he was just like talking, very casual, very relaxed. Everything, like all of the stress and tension of the event, was gone. And there was an incredible sanctuary, a new sanctuary, an open and curious sanctuary that was discovered in that moment. So there were three things happening there. I was in my own turmoil, the country and the state of society at large was in turmoil, and then that turmoil literally wandered into our house all in one fell swoop. And so the lyrics of that song, like as you read them out loud, that was kind of creepy to realize, just hearing you speak the words, just how true they felt. And there's a lot of venom on my tongue that day when I wrote that song,
Was I wrong to think that you were also commenting on the state of our country?
That's it. I mean, yes. And oddly enough, Icy Refrain was one of the last lyrics I wrote. And it was in an early round of rounding up immigrants. And it wasn't called ICE at the time, which is interesting, because I said Icy Refrain, but I didn't, I little did I know that a few years later, there would really be this icy refrain. And I think it was a really interesting moment for me to unpack these very, very deeply stored, like deep storage, cold storage feelings, and perform them anew, you know, using the track that we had recorded from then and reading out those lyrics, but also understanding so much more about my own internal landscape than I did back then, you know.
You were in June, you participated in a video series, Songs of the US, that features iconic American songs to mark the country's 250th birthday. You chose Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land, which I understand is also partly the inspiration of Trespassing. What does that song mean to you?
Do you know the verse? There's the verse about no tr the sign that says no trespassing, but
Yes.
on the other side it didn't say nothing. So that was my favorite verse since
Well,
I was 17.
sing that verse for people who don't
So
know it,
as
because it.
I, there's a few different ways that it's sung, and Woody sang it differently depending on his audience. But there was one version I learned in Brownies in Facedon, Vermont. As I was walking that ribbon of highway, there was a wall that said private property, but on the other side, it didn't say nothing. That side is made for you and me. So what's interesting is the actual lyric, when you look it up online, the Wikipedia and the Library of Congress say that Woody Guthrie says it wasn't the ribbon of highway lyric leading it off. It was, as I was walking, I saw a wall there, and there was a sign that said no trespassing. So I never sang it that way, but I didn't learn it that way, but I like it so much. And he would often omit that verse because he knew it would bum people out. So he saved it for certain audiences, which I also thought was really interesting. It's almost like
I did
he's,
not know that he
yeah.
didn't sing it. I mean, I've often thought that was like one of the most revolutionary lines
I
or
agree.
verses that he wrote.
Yeah. And he refrained from it, and he would replace it with the one about the church. And then sometimes he would omit the church verse. So these are some interesting things I learned as I was diving into that project with the Salt Lick Sessions and the Hearthland Foundation. And it was a very cool deep dive, which I had been toying with whether to call the album Trespasser at that point. And that just absolutely 100% gelled my confidence in calling it that, because it was the engine that was running all of my lyrical landscaping at that point.
So Woody Guthrie, obviously, an icon of the tradition of kind of
Yeah.
social commentator as well as musician. Do you feel like you are part of that tradition in your own way?
I think I was raised with a pretty heavy dose of folklore. And I think there is that sort of journeyman energy to my family's story as well as my own, you know, my family sort of unhitching from the origin or the original American dream, and sort of building their own new American dream with all the ridiculousness that comes with it. I mean, I bought this farm and this airport right here in my backyard. I'm pretty sure was actually for cocaine running. Like I don't think they were
There's
really
an
doing.
airport in your yard?
There used to be an airstrip in my yard. The map will still show that there is one, but I can promise you right now, there is no way. I've had several pilots come to the property and say, I would never land here. This is not safe. But it does feel like there was a level of hubris in even my parents sort of evangelizing this new way of living, that even as a kid, I knew they were so cool and they were doing something really amazing and revolutionary. And I knew how lucky I was. Like I never thought I wasn't a very lucky kid to have grown up where I did. But I also knew that there was a lot more out there in the world, and I became curious about it. And if not curious, maybe even a little bit guilty. Like I felt like I had gotten away with something already. Like my whole life, I was kind of on this very privileged and lucky end of things. And I needed to, if I was going to be a great songwriter, a true songwriter, that I needed to unhitch from that narrative and spend some time in the real world, as it were, whatever that is, you know, and be very mindful of the stories that I run into from walks of life with people where I could never assume to know what it's like to be them, but I can listen and I can engage and understand slowly what it's like.
You spoke about a week ago at a new film festival in Waitsfield called Through Ellie's Eyes, named for a mutual young friend that you and I have, Ellie Curtis, a beautiful young college student who tragically died in a skiing accident. While you were on that panel, and you also sang a beautiful song in her honor called Through Ellie's Eyes. On that panel, you were asked by somebody in the audience to name a mentor. And I was really curious. Oh, yeah, right. I'm thinking, oh, she's going to say like Aretha Franklin or, some incredible musician. And you instead, you mentioned an English teacher you had from Harwood Union High School. Tell us about the impact that that teacher, Gretchen Stahl, had on you.
You know, everybody called her Stahl. It wasn't Mrs. Stahl or Miss Stahl or Gretchen. It was Stahl
And you
because,
were Miss Potter.
and I, yes, and always Miss Potter, 5 minute rites in the morning, and she calls you out. You have to be ready to read aloud your 5 minute rite. I think it really did get me on the track of songwriting, because so often I would find myself writing in couplets because I knew she couldn't argue with a couplet. There's something, if I could put nonsensical, if I could string together nonsensical words in a way that felt even slightly iambic, she would. And I'm sorry, I'm sort of leaping ahead. For those of you who don't know who Gretchen Stahl is, she was a longstanding institution at Harwood Union High School and deeply influential, not just on me or a few people, but on many hundreds of kids.
My daughter among them.
I was going to say, I believe you said your daughter was among them and the
Yes.
last to receive a full 4 year, a 4 years of Stahl, which, you know, I was afraid of her because my sister was afraid of her. My older sister had gone through her course and had really struggled. And Stahl really, she went against the grain of excellence. Her definition of excellence was something indeterminate, and it was a quality. She was looking for a quality in someone that I believe rendered surprise. I think that was what she was always looking for, was to feel awe, especially through the words and wisdom that can come with these feral years of teenagerhood, because that's where she, I mean, it is a wild, wild ride to jump into the educator position and specifically say, yeah, I want the 13 to 18 year olds. Give me those crazy people. Because it was, you know, an incredibly tumultuous time. I think it will always be. That is the time in our lives. It's the most formative and the most tumultuous. And that's the time she found to be the most fascinating. It's a human experience that I think she was not tethered to it. She was completely and comfortably detached and yet had a compassion and an awareness that if there was ever a moment to bring empowerment and possibility into the minds of young people, it was right in that crucial 4 years. And my sister was terrified of that. I think there was a lot of pressure, and I just remember the stress and fear that my sister would come home with. And I think being the middle child to a high achieving, very popular older sister who was already like varsity soccer freshman year. And she was just humming along, doing everything great. And to see that there was a teacher there that challenged my sister inspired me to immediately sign up and say, I want that. Because by the end of those 4 years, not only was I grateful, but everyone in the class, it was like trauma bonding, maybe. I'm not totally sure. But the influence is undeniable, and it really did, I think, firmly plant me in a place of creative. I think I didn't have to make a lot of I didn't have to make a lot of corrections to my first instinct. It was simply, am I stating it clearly? Is it prose or is it a lyric, Potter? Because Miss Potter, if you're speaking in lyrical terms, that was beautiful. If that was your 5 minute write this morning, you need to work on it. The grammar was incorrect, and you could have said what you just said in five words instead of the 35 that you chose to put into that. Yeah.
So that voice is still in your ear as you
Always.
compose music.
Always. Yeah, I have Stahl is my permanent New York Times editor of all of my lyrics.
Well,
Yeah.
that is amazing. And for people who are listening, the Gretchen Stahl is alive and well, lives in Montpelier, has done been teaching adult ed and other things in the years since her high school teaching.
She's
So a shout
incredible.
out to
Yeah.
Miss Stahl, as she was known among her
She's
students, you among them. I want to talk about last year you released a long-lost album, Medicine, that had been in the vault for 18 years. Talk about what happened to that album and why you finally decided to release it.
I had 10 years with Disney at Hollywood Records. I was signed to that label. It was the greatest and most exciting time in my career. I was deeply motivated to score movies, to voice character actors. I wanted to be a character actor, you know, and even when I went and decided I wanted to major in film at St. Lawrence University, never did the performance and the lust for being in the spotlight go away. But I did feel that coming from Vermont, that my opportunities might be limited. And yet none of that was true. Again, trespassing on these stories that we tell ourselves and these internal monologues that we sort of carve into our identity are really best left to be questioned at all times. And in the moments before I signed with Hollywood Records and Disney, I knew that there was a very big story coming, a bigger wave of opportunity than I could have ever had. So, day one signing with Disney, I said I wanted to make a record with T-Bone Burnett. I
This was
was,
a legendary producer,
yes,
record producer.
T-Bone Burnett also was the music supervisor for some of my favorite Coen Brothers films, and Coen Brothers continue to be my favorite set of directors, both individually and collectively, and influenced a huge amount of my screenwriting and my, I don't know, mise-en-scène. Whenever I set my storylines for my songs, I'm always in a Coen Brothers movie. So there's a lot of tone and texture to a T-Bone Burnett record, and I think maybe it was more mature tone and texture than Disney was willing to market. And it was sort of collectively decided by a large team of people who'd spent a lot of money developing me that for me to go solo, because it would have been a solo record because T-Bone brought in his own band. It was essentially Tom Waits's band plus Jim Keltner on the drums. No slouches over there, but it wasn't the Nocturnals. And we had really made a concerted effort, especially on my behest, to feature the band and to make the band and the story of a real rock band that had really gone out there and grinded away and paid our dues and continued to gig, that hard work wasn't going to go unnoticed. And I wasn't just going to go to Hollywood and cut tail, what do you tuck tail and run and go solo. So it was a bit of a PR decision there. But I wouldn't blame it on any one piece of Disney that they decided to not tackle this big transition for me as an artist going solo. It was more that the record itself felt really mature. And they are not in the business of marketing mature 27-year-olds. I think I was 26 or 25 even when I first met with T-Bone about making this record. And ultimately in the studio, I think I was 27 or 28 by the time this dream came true. But it does sound mature. And when you listen to the record now, it was exactly in the texture and tone of everything I had wanted. I got everything I wanted, and I guess it was sort of collectively decided by this larger group of people that were my management team and my bandmates, who were pretty crusty about me going off and doing a solo record, that it wouldn't serve my career to split off and go solo in that moment. And
You were crushed by
I
that
was
decision.
crushed. Yeah. I really,
I mean, you had
really
put
just,
everything into this. It was your dream producer. You
I really
finished
just,
the recording and they killed it.
they killed it. It's not the first time that a larger company than you could ever really stand up to decides this, we put the money in, this was our money, our investment, and we can take it away. But I don't think it was this power play of like, you don't get to succeed. I think they were worried that it wouldn't succeed, which I thought was a really interesting take on what I think is a profoundly cool record. And I think it would have twisted my career in a completely different direction, you know?
For better or worse.
Who knows? And that's, I think I've been living in multiple dimensions ever since then. I'm still on that plane of reality. I think it's why I'm such a bozo, you know?
I'm so curious, Grace, what it's like for you, what it was like for you to deep dive back into your 20-something self and listen to a much younger Grace Potter, and just to sit back and try and be a musical pro now and say, let's see what I think. What do you think?
I loved it more than I thought I would. I remember listening to it. I was in New Orleans when the master finally came back through from Disney. And by the way, shout out to Ken Bunt, who at the time that that decision was made, he was just like a lowly marketing exec, you know, with like these little, you know, he had a lot of action figures in his window, and they were all like weird, non-real action figures, like Mr. Mullet, you know, and like this guy was just this like quirky, wonderful marketing director who now runs the Disney Music Group. But our bond and our understanding of one another, I think on my career path, were always really aligned. And when I did call and finally implore him to consider diving into the vault to pull out the masters, he was as stoked as I was. You know, he was like, yeah, let's see. Sure, let's try it. Why not? I mean, listen, we already spent the money on it. Let's do it, you know, because now, at 42, 43, which is how old I was when the record finally came out. 42, I think. That's how I believe they felt that if I was a 40-year-old artist at the time, it would have been the appropriate record to put out. But I think they really wanted to ride the wave of my youth and this sort of burning rock pop hitting the radio hard, you know, really we were edging into the industry in a really interesting way in the early 2000s, and it gave us some space to look at all that and say, all right, well, now I am the age that that record made me sound like. Why not, you know, put that out? That wasn't my logic, but I do think that there must have been some thought put into it, because it you know, it was a ballsy move to take my work and go back and re-examine it. And what if I didn't like it, but they had already said yes? Then I would have felt, okay, well, now I have to do it, you know. But they were just so free and easy with the whole situation, and so many of the staff that I had worked with 20 years ago were still there. And it was quite a reunion. It was a really interesting and not as tumultuous as I expected experience to wander back into that landscape.
Is what we're hearing a straight take from that 20 year ago session, or
Yes.
did you didn't do
Yes.
change it?
There was a couple of things that I suggested that we change. For example, the word gypsy, which is apparently not, I have to put a plug in my thing, so hang on a second. The word gypsy was being contested as a potentially not so great word to use anymore, but it was argued that it let's just go as is. Let's just leave it as is, you know. And there was a few things legally that made it so that there was performances on there from people who didn't want to be on there, basically did not sign a release to be included in that recording. And so it felt like, okay, well, we will honor anyone who did not sign a release or make, you know, sign some kind of a recording agreement to begin with. So I'm sorry, you're going to lose the beautiful setting, but you're going to gain a woman who's not losing.
You've just given me a tour of your house as you're carrying your laptop in
Yes.
search of a power plug.
I know. I thought I had a power cable at that desk. I have several desks in this house, but now you're going to get the full thing. And the tractor's going out in the field right now. And the fire is not ours, by the way. I was able to confirm that.
Okay, right. Before we got on, you were seeing a fire out your window, which I know from following you on social media is a kind of terrifying thing for you. You fled a huge wildfire near your California home last year.
Yeah, in fact, the fire break road that was created was actually the break was at our house. So one of the petroleum t like we have two propane tanks behind our house. One of them burned, and the one that was attached to our house directly next to it did not burn. So that was
Okay, I
how
think
close
we're
it was.
now in your recording studio.
Yes, this is our control room. Welcome to
Wow,
command
okay.
control.
I'm seeing a lot of serious recording equipment there. Are you recording albums now in your home studio?
I'm currently working on just a single. I'm working on a song in honor of my friend Jessica Meir, commander of Crew 12, who's up on the International Space Station as we speak. And I'm working on just a single, like a little hit single, called "Spacewalkin' Woman," because she just completed today was her fourth spacewalk of this mission, which means her eighth spacewalk total, no, seventh spacewalk total. And she's my hero and one of my best friends in the whole world. And she called me just yesterday from space. I got this unknown call in the midst of my interviews. I was like, "I'm sorry, but the U.S. government is calling me. I have to pick this up. It's the only thing that cuts through my do not disturb." So.
Okay,
If
yes.
she calls, I'm going to hang up on you and pick up.
If I get preempted by an astronaut in outer space, yes, your star will only rise higher. I understand your dream is to be an astronaut.
I think artists should go to space. I think that the overview effect is a no joke, transcendent and ever. I think it changes the way you look at the world for all time on a biological level. Similar to how my biology changed when this man trespassed in our house, I feel strongly that the overview effect is something that scientists know or at least desperately try to make sense of. And I think that artists wouldn't feel the urge to make sense of it quite so quickly. And to be able to verbalize it in the same way. There's that amazing scene in the movie Contact where Jodie Foster, arrives in Vega and she says there's no words. They should have sent a poet. And
That's you.
that's what I would like to do.
Be the poet in space.
But they can't have me like running the machinery or anything.
That might be dangerous.
I'm legally blind, so I don't even know if I would qualify. But I would absolutely go to astronaut school and go through whatever grueling experiences were necessary. It's really a question of the qualifications. And I mean, I do hold two honorary doctorates, but I don't know if that
From
counts.
where?
Middlebury College and Lake and Sh Champlain College.
Wow.
Yeah, and a fake degree from St. Lawrence because I made them give me one because they kept using me in their alumni thing. And I was like, "Hey, y'all, I never graduated. I never
Yeah.
graduated from St. Lawrence." So they did give me an honorary degree from St. Lawrence. And then I got two honorary doctorates.
Well, congrats on that, Dr.
It's just
Potter.
complete nonsense. Do you see what I'm saying? Why do you think I call my record trespasser? Because, sure, call me a doctor. I didn't do any of that work. Gretchen Stahl would be mortified, like
She would still call you Miss, not
she
Dr.
would
Potter.
never call me Dr. Potter. And I, if she ever did, I would absolutely plots. I would plots. That's it. That would be the end of it. So,
So I was surprised, and I think some of your fans would be surprised to learn that you don't read music. Is that right?
correct. I do not read music. Sorry, Eric has decided to do all the art in our hallway over with all
It's
these.
very nice art. We're walking through your house again, even though I'm not in your house.
I know I'm giving I didn't mean to be giving you a tour, but that charger cable was not charging and I'm at 4% juice on my computer, so I just don't want to mess Listen,
Okay.
I'm having too much fun talking to you.
We have to
So,
talk fast then.
no, I got it. I got it. I got the right thing now. We're in the kitchen.
Okay.
So, I'm sorry.
You
What?
don't read music. So
I do not read music. Correct.
why is that? And I also want to know how your music maybe reflects a different way of channeling what you feel that isn't It doesn't involve reading music.
It's more about what okay, I'm going to use an analogy that Julia Roberts said about what makes her a great actor. She said, "I hope I never find out, because if I knew, it would ruin everything, and I would never understand or trust my impulses again. If I was able to place my knowledge and understanding of what is doing this thing, all of that seasoning and that sauce and that humanness that seems to come through me would be smack there in the middle and reminding me, okay, don't forget to do that cute thing with your eyebrow. Don't forget to do that cute thing where your ear kind of goes down and your vein sticks out of your forehead." You know, she said, "I have no idea what it is, and I hope I never find out." So, I'm not quite that. I do actually, I am curious, and I do like getting a bit sciencey about what it is that makes me musical. I do know that in the same positive memories I have of Gretchen Stahl, I have not so great memories of getting kicked out of the high school band at Harwood for pretending to read music. Apparently, I did the sight reading test and I sort of made like a concentration face, you know, like, "Oh, I'm gonna work really hard to try and, you know, sight read this thing." But I had actually just been like sitting outside of the audition room door, listening to all the other kids, and I had deduced that there were only three pieces of music, so the odds of anybody messing up the sight reading test was really based on me just going last. And I could hear multiple other kids playing through the sight reading, was able to recognize those melodies, and then when I saw the paper, I could sort of figure out based on the music notes generally which one of those three musical pieces was the one. And then I was like, thought I was so smart about that, that I then was bragging about it to another kid. And so essentially I was caught cheating on the sight reading test. So
I mean, what you're describing also for people who can't read
yeah.
and they go through life, many people don't realize it because they learn all these workarounds. They learn ways to kind of fool people, and get by.
And I
That's
think, again, this is the trespasser conversation coming back, because I do feel like my career and the opportunities that I have had have been, there's something grandiose about what I've done, audacious. And I will often get off stage and look at my bandmates or look at whoever is there side stage and go, "I just got away with it again. Like I'm robbing a bank or something." I would love to say that the money I earn reflects that, but it doesn't. The music industry has changed considerably, and it is a struggle to continue this life. And my passion and my commitment to it and basically all forms of art is mostly based on my fascination with how I'm able to get away with this over and over again, honestly. If you really, I don't think I've ever said that out loud, but I'm telling you now, like, this is the big scoop of the interview. If you want a scoop, it's just that I continue to be rewarded for something that comes extremely naturally to me. And I'm lucky enough to have been kind of cattle prodded into it by really encouraging, inspired, wonderful family members and friends and cohorts who saw what I had better than I did. Yeah.
You sound like you're describing imposter syndrome, but
Yeah.
you, it's not imposter. You know, you have an incredible talent that you've come to through kind of a different lane, a different door.
Yeah, I went in the back door. I'm a service entrance kind of person. Like, you know, I even the farm that we bought here in the Mad River Valley is a farm that I remember looking at, and I always thought, what a beautiful farmhouse that is. I would probably be put on the back 40 of that property. And lo and behold, we are now living in the barn in the back 40 of that property. I do not live in the fancy white farmhouse. I don't want to. It doesn't feel genuine to live that kind of life. I don't need the fancy house. I need my instruments and my art nearby.
I want to talk about ask you about this spring. You traveled to Capitol Hill with other musicians and artists to advocate for protection from AI and digital piracy. I saw a picture of Senator Peter Welch videotaping you because I guess he looked like a starstruck fan as you were testifying or
Yeah.
talking. What's the issue here, and why does it matter to you?
So what's going on is that artists across the board, and I'm talking about Prince and David Bowie and Cyndi Lauper and Michael Jackson, all the way through to the guy on the back porch who finally had, the belief in himself to finally upload it onto SoundCloud last week. Everyone is having their material scraped. So the second it's digitized, it is being scraped by these machines that are learning. So these machine learning models are scraping, but then within each of those companies, there is a safeguard for each of those companies to keep them from being liable for these pieces of material that they're scraping. Essentially, they create a digital paper shredder. So they digitize and they break apart all the information they have scraped in a way that cannot be put back together to be identified as any single piece of music. And then they lock that behind a firewall that they call black boxing. So once your material has been scraped and black boxed, there is no way for you to legally litigate or defend your material as source for a piece of AI composition. Now that's part one. Part two is that AI compositions are climbing the charts as we speak. There are 44,000 AI songs and AI artists arriving every day on Spotify. And so if that's happening, and 44,000 is where we were at back in March. Now it has probably increased exponentially since then, but on the gospel charts, six of the 10 top 10 gospel artists are not real artists. And those
Wow.
songs are not real songs, not written by humans. They are all written by prompts. So you have all these apps where you can say, hey, I want you to write a song that sounds like Hall and Oates meets that song that Nancy Kerrigan figure skated to in the 92 Olympics. And then I want you to put it to the backbeat of a hip hop thing and make that the top line and then have something like a Kendrick Lamar rapper rap over it. And these robots will take from the scrape in their black boxes and they will formulate and coagulate lyrics based on that music, based on that top lines and all these. The more descriptive you are, the more it scrapes for things that it understands as similar to. So it's diving deep and it will somehow, in the course of this very strange process, it will scrape through probably thousands of artists so that really no one can ever quite claim it as theirs. But that's just in the musical realm. We are also defending against, and so there's three acts that we were talking about on Capitol Hill. There's the No Fakes, there's the Train, which has got the Train is the one that's essentially talking about the machine learning model and unboxing the black boxes and trying to sort of retread the paper trail and go back in time and undo some of the really, really serious damage that's been done to these artists who will never be compensated for their work. And then the third is sort of a larger bill that would tie a lot of these things together and also protect voices. So voice, this is actors, this is the deep fakes of Becca Blint or Bernie or Peter Welch or me or you. That our voices are also biologically identified as human. So that essentially, no matter how many times you break it apart and black box it, you can still identify exactly which genome of a human it came from. And so we are now, in the process of trying to track back through the logs of damage done. And it's incomparable to anything we have been through as a human race. And so it feels like an important thing to go to Capitol Hill and talk about.
Have you personally been impacted, like people ripping off, your name,
Oh yeah.
likeness, sound, everything?
All the time. I mean, I kind of, this is the problem with artists though, is that it's like this weird compliment, and it's all fascinating. You see it and it's like going to a freak show or a zoo or seeing a car accident on the side of the road. We are curious creatures and we lean into these things. So we are just at the sort of point of impact with AI where we are still both charmed by it and terrified by it, but we can't look away. And there are so many times where I've seen these iterations of my face, my music, my brand, then being recreated as Gracie Mae, and it's a combination of me and Macy Gray put together into a new AI artist. There's a lot of times where the textures of a song and even the mix of a song, like Eric will hear it, and my husband, Eric Valentine, very, very well-known record producer with some pretty iconic recordings. His style of recording and the way he creates an earworm is a very specific trick of his own wizardry that really can't be recreated, except that it's being recreated. And I will hear something that will pull my ear and go, I think I hear an Eric song. And then I listen a little closer and I'm, in a mall somewhere and it's not quite Smash Mouth and it's not quite Third Eye Blind. It is something else and it is not human.
Wow.
And it's a very strange feeling because it's not just scary, it's fascinating. And that's really where we will go a bridge too far before we understand what we've done. And I think I'm just sort of taking stock of that along with many of my confeder, what do you call it? Not your federation of your, not your brethren. There's a word for this. I guess I should say compadres. My
Your
compadre.
tribe.
Yeah, well, there's no right word for it. It's kind of like gypsy. It's like even the replacement word I come up with won't be the right thing. But essentially, the group of us who have started galvanized together and started to really try and make an impact and speak out to this are even still absorbing how many ways in which this strange new songwriting tool could really undo all of human creation and creativity,
Finally, Grace, you are about to embark on a national tour, including playing with country star Chris Stapleton and your annual Grand Point North Festival in Burlington, Vermont. What are you most excited about on this tour?
I am most excited about Grand Point North because after many years of having this be a commercial endeavor, it is officially 100% nonprofit. My foundation, Grand Point Foundation, which is devoted to supporting rural creatives across the state of Vermont, that have, having grown up in that echo chamber myself, like not knowing like what's a CD and how do I make one? What, you know what I mean? Like from those early days all the way through till now, I think there's a really important thread of community and authenticity and the networking that all Vermonters strive for. And there's an entrepreneurial spirit to the way I was raised. And I want to take some of that ethos and bring it forth and create platforms and networks and support groups and workshops, as well as grants. And so propping up other artists and helping them to crystallize into the creative spirits that they want to be and feel free enough to be able to do that and not have to just call it a hobby on the side, I think that's a really important piece of it. And the festival itself is I think it's sort of the center of the tent pole for me in my purpose and my cause and the reason why I've lost a lot of money throwing that music festival over the years is because it was never about making money. And so to make it a complete nonprofit allows me to really show how I want to give back, not just in a quick one flash weekend, but over the course of the year and through our programming. So this is September 18th through the 20th this year. And it's a combination of, national acts. We have Portugal the Man and Jackson Brown, my Grammy nominee fellow, Maggie Rose, Dawes, All the Rivers, Devil Makes Three, Trampled by Turtles, Dark Star Orchestra, Dogs in a Pile. Featured on the main stage will be a Vermont, a really amazing songwriter who I've since connected with through the foundation. Her name is Frankie White, and she's super talented and amazing. And I'm really enjoying watching her, just sort of chart her course and sign a record deal. And it's just fun to watch other people expand and find their people and find their audience. So the festival is going to be, I think, for the first time ever, very, very much centered on honoring the culture that I grew up in that really built me and gave me the bravery and the audacity to trespass upon the world as I have.
Well, Grace Potter, I want to thank you for joining us on the Vermont Conversation. I'll look forward to seeing you at Rand Point North.
I will too. I'll see you there. Thank you, David.
Vermont-born musician and four-time Grammy nominee Grace Potter has a new album, Trespasser, that drops August 21st. She'll be headlining the Grand Point North Festival in Burlington on September 18th. That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman, and let's go out with another clip from Grace Potter's new album. The song is called Belong.
There's a place I'm trying to find. I've been searching my whole life. Somewhere I can be at peace. When I was a little child, I could see for miles and miles. I could hear the sunset calling me. Headlong in the howling wind, that's the way it all began. I lit out with my suitcase full of dreams.